all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossum.
And good afternoon. This is Jim Fossone for Veterans Radio, and sitting with me, Dale Thronberry. How you doing, Dale?
I'm doing swell, Jim. I hope Thanksgiving was good for you.
It was. The turkey was delicious, and I had more than my share. So
I know. That's the problem, and we still have another one coming up
exactly.
In a couple of more weeks. But
We want to welcome everybody who's listening today, whether you're listening live on WAAM 1600 Talk Radio out of Ann Arbor or listening to us at veteransradio.net or on the Internet. Welcome. We've got a great show. We're going to talk about a couple of interesting topics. The first will be about Metro Airport's Freedom Center, and the second half hour will be about The Speed of Heat by Thomas W. Young, an airlift wing at war in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I think everybody will find both of those topics very interesting. But as we always do at the top of the show, we talk about some upcoming things. One in my pile that I wanted to mention, because I think it's a great way to honor our departed veterans, is Wreath Across America. I'm sure you've heard of that, Dale.
Yeah, we've talked with them in the past too. Usually every year about this time is we talk to the people with Wreaths Across America. They have a great goal in mind of what they want to try and do.
So we got contacted for the Great Lakes National Cemetery. Wreaths Across America will be placing wreaths at the Great Lakes National Cemetery in Holly on Saturday, December 13th at 10:30 a.m. and that takes them till about 1 p.m. that day to accomplish that. And I'm sure if that's something your group, your veteran service organization or a church group or faith-based organization would be interested in, you can internet search for Wreaths Across America at the Great Lakes National Cemetery and find a way to get involved, because it really is truly a great way to honor those who have reached their final resting place in a national cemetery.
It's a great organization. As I said, we did a number of years ago, we tried to simulcast our program on video, and we had a lot of pictures of all the wreaths across America. And it's just, again, it's a fascinating organization, and I encourage people to go. I think it's just wreathsacrossamerica.org. Actually, if you go to that website, you'll find out what they're, the help that they need. They want to put a wreath on every veteran's grave across the country. That's a lot.
That is a lot. Yeah. And one of the places that you can go to look for those types of opportunities, veteran-centric opportunities, is a website the state of Michigan runs called www.michiganveteranresources.com. And they have an events tab that you can go to and see what's coming up that might be of interest to you or your organization. I also wanted to mention one other thing before we turn to our special announcement. A couple of weeks back, Dale, you mentioned an upcoming A&E television program called Dogs of War.
Right.
And on Veterans Radio, we've had a lot of programs about veterans and their dogs.
They seem to go together somehow there. I'm not sure. But, yeah, dog programs are always the most popular, it seems.
And one of the ones that I've done in the last year was with Stiggy's Dogs, which is a organization here in mid-Michigan that works on training, matching rescue dogs with veterans who need service dogs, and does all the training for them. So when you mentioned Dogs of War, I made it a point to watch it on A&E, and I have to say it's a really good show. I think I would encourage our listeners to look on that for A&E and Dogs of War, because I think it gives you a realistic look at a small slice of veterans who struggle with PTSD or TBI, and where a service dog is really therapeutic. So it's a great look inside the lives of some young veterans and the value that service dogs bring to that equation.
What channel was that on again?
A&E.
A&E. So yes. You could probably go on your computer or at home and look it up on demand.
I suspect you can. So I wanted to mention that you had brought it up, and we followed up on it.
It's nice to know that somebody follows my advice every once in a while.
Somebody
once in a while.
So,
somebody is listening.
But that gets us to a program that you've been tracking for a number of years now. Why don't you go ahead and talk about Honor and Remember?
I will do that. And as a matter of fact, on our line right now is one of the founders of the Michael Strange Foundation. And this is Charles Strange. Charles, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
It is my pleasure. Charles and I talked a little bit earlier, and he's out in Philadelphia on the East Coast, which is where I'm from originally. I can fall right back into my accent and feel really cool. But you were talking about that you had just done one of these dinners, these types of dinners, down in Wildwood, which is on the Jersey Shore, correct?
Yes. We had 22 Gold Star parents come into Wildwood, New Jersey. They stayed at the Bolero Hotel. The DAV down there in Wildwood used their new van to pick up the parents at Philadelphia Airport, and a lot of veterans, all veterans, and active military. One Marine came in his dress blues, drove Gold Star father Doug Hamburger and his wife. His son was Patrick, that died with my son. And it was a beautiful weekend. We had workshops with paid grief counselors. Knights of Columbus had a dinner for us Saturday night. They had the fire engines, motorcycles out. And across the street was the ocean, and we had 30 reefs made up, a reef round like a circle. Mm-hmm. The circle never ends, just like our love for our sons never did. And each parent released a reef and said a few words about their parents, about their sons. It was beautiful.
It sounds like a very powerful event. Charles, tell us about what's coming up next weekend, I believe it is.
Yes, Sunday.
Sunday, right. This is another one of your fun. Go ahead.
We're going down to George Hutz's Honor and Remember to meet Dennis Miller and some more Gold Star families, and have a weekend down there and meet some more Gold Star parents. We're in the club nobody wants to belong to, and find out, you know, with the grief counseling and just to help with the holidays. It's good to be amongst the people, the Gold Stars, and we help each other out, just like with the Michael Strange Foundation. Honor our sons and try to help each other through the holidays.
Just for our audience sake, and I know it's always difficult to talk about, but tell us a little bit about Michael and what happened to him.
Michael was a CTR1. He was a cryptologist, code breaker. He just received the National Medal of Valor from James Clapper. Mm-hmm. Only 19 have been given out in the history of America. We didn't know Michael was that smart. He was a Tier 1 team leader for SEAL Team 6 Gold. He was with SEAL Team 6 for 4 years. And he died with 30 guys August 6, 2011, the biggest loss of life in the Iraq and Afghan War, and the biggest loss of life in the history of America, 22 guys from Death Group.
Right.
And Bark the dog. I heard you guys mentioning the dogs. John Dugandero, who was on the helicopter with Michael, his buddy, he passed through on August 6th.
Mm-hmm. I think what we'd like to do at some point, Charles, is to have you back on the program to talk about, you know, your son and just the whole thing. I mean, we just did a program a couple of weeks ago with a couple of SEAL members retired, and they talked about their careers, and they're amazing group of men, and I'd like to do that. So tell me how you got Dennis Miller involved in this dinner that's coming up, and let's promote the date and where it's going to be.
It's December 7th, Founders Inn, Virginia Beach, Virginia. We have a meet and greet before the parents, and then he's going to do one of his shows and a dinner down there. This is mostly run by George. George reached out to me to reach some more Gold Star parents, invite them down. And George is coming to our next weekend. We're having one in Boulder, Colorado in May. and just try to, you know, strengthen our hearts. It's 1.4 either a mom, dad, brother, or sister that lost somebody in Iraq and Afghanistan,
mm-hmm.
either commits suicide or dies from what we lost in Iraq and Afghan war.
Well,
so there's a big need, you know, for the Gold Star families and reach out for support.
Well, Charles, this is Jim Fausson. I want to say this is great work that you're doing, and I think if I have the information right, folks, if they're in the Virginia Beach, Virginia area, if they went to www.honorandremember.info, they can obtain some information on this particular dinner. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's still some seats available. It's December 7th. I believe it starts at 5 o'clock. Get there early, Dennis Miller, and there's two vets going to be there doing a few, saying a few words about their history with the war and a few things about what's going on with America and, you know, showing their support. There'll be a couple hundred people there.
Mm-hmm.
And the founders in Virginia Beach, Virginia.
I think it's great. And I would encourage people to go to your website, the Michael Strange Foundation's website, to there's a video in there, and you have to kind of go through their pages to find it. But it explains exactly what they're doing, and there's some really great testimonials to the work that you and your organization are doing. And, again, I want to thank you so much for all the work that you are doing, and our prayers are out to you and your family, and, of course, to all the Gold Star families.
Thank you. Thank you so much. MichaelStrangeFoundation.org, and we have a three-minute video, workshop video. The next one from Wildwood should be up by the end of the next week with all the other parents. We have T-shirts and PayPal, SEAL Team 6 shirts, and we're 501c3. And you can always check on our calendar. We have different events up here in Philadelphia, and we had a couple Navy SEALs at the last one, and just to support the Gold Star families.
We will do that. Thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio, and we'll be talking to you again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Charles. And with that, we'll play a short PSA from Dennis Miller about this particular program, and when we come back, we'll talk to Colonel Ken Pratt from the Freedom Center.
Dennis Miller here. I wanted to let you know that I'm going to be in Virginia Beach on Sunday, December 7th. My good friend George Lutz, the father of a fallen hero and the founder of one of my favorite organizations, Honor and Remember, has invited me to honor the many families of those military heroes that have given their lives for our country. I will be speaking, performing, meeting, and enjoying myself at the 5th Annual Honor and Remember Gold Star Family Evening at the Founders Inn on Sunday, December 7th, and I'd like you to join me. Every family that makes the ultimate sacrifice, losing someone they love for our freedoms, deserve to be recognized and know that their loved one's life and sacrifice will be forever remembered.
Join Dennis Miller at the Founders Inn December 7th for an evening you'll never forget. For tickets, visit honorandremember.org, honorandremember.org, or call 504-4722.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And welcome back to Veterans Radio. If you're listening to us on veteransradio.net, live on the Internet, or on WAAM Talk 1600, we're glad to have you. If you have a question for any of our guests, you can call 844-838-1600 or locally in Southeast Michigan, 734-822-1600. Dale Thronberry and Jim Fausson are pleased to welcome to the show Colonel Ken Pratt. Ken, how are you?
Very well, thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here.
We're glad to have you. Ken is a retired colonel, retired, I think, at this point, Ken, from Delta as a pilot on 757s and 767s, I think. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, we're glad you can join us from St. Louis, Missouri, this Thanksgiving weekend, and to talk a little bit about an organization that you're instrumental in, and that's the Michigan Armed Forces Hospitality Center, which operates the Freedom Center at Detroit Metro Airport.
That's correct. We have just this month completed our third year of operation. And basically what the Freedom Center offers to the military travelers coming through Detroit Metro Airport is a bit of a hospitality center where they can come in and take advantage of all of the amenities that we offer. There's snacks and beverages, but also free internet, cable TV, computers available, printer, and a whole host of other travel-related services where we try to meet the needs, the unique needs of military travelers. And this, I might add, is all complimentary.
Ken, when did the Freedom Center get started?
It actually was incorporated a little over 3 years ago, and as of November of this year, we've hosted over 120,000 military personnel coming through Detroit Airport.
And I believe the group or this concept kind of got started with Delta Airlines back in December of 2010. Is that correct?
Yes, actually it was the kernel of the idea was formed in the winter of 2009 and 2010, and then again repeated in 2010-2011, where group of Delta employees opened a temporary holiday military lounge and for a couple of weeks offered snacks and beverages to the GIs traveling through McNamara Terminal in Detroit. And from that, a group of us sat down and said, this has been so successful. The support from the community has been outstanding. Let's do this not just at the holidays, but all year round.
A little surprising that as busy as Detroit Metro is and the hub that it is, that it never had a military or veterans center that you see at so many other airports. Was that something that just seemed to be lacking because nobody got it off the ground?
Well, I don't know the entire history of why it took so long, but I've been affiliated with the airlines and with Detroit Metro for most of the last 30 years. And during that time, both in the old terminal and now in the new McNamara terminal, there never was a military lounge per se. And I have heard that individuals during that period often asked the question why there wasn't, and they would approach the airport authorities or the mayor or the airlines, and they'd say, you know, what's the deal? Why don't we have one? And nobody had a good answer. And so finally, seeing that need, the group of us that were active back in 2011 got together and we said, okay, we're going to fix this problem. And we networked with the airport authority, Wayne County Airport Authority, and the airlines, and a whole host of other support organizations, and launched this project in November of 2011. And we've been open every single day since then, from 6 in the morning until nearly midnight. And like I said, we've hosted 120,000 guests.
Ken, the location of that lounge, is that does it move around or does it stay in one spot at the airport?
It's a very much a fixed location. We're near gate A43, which is in the McNamara terminal where Delta Airlines operates out of. And it's very near the center of that concourse. You may be familiar with that large water fountain. We're just behind that.
Having been to the lounge a couple of times myself, I know that's sort of prime real estate. How did you get that arranged?
Well, as I have said in many cases, the whole evolution of this concept and the implementation and the support has been a series of minor miracles. And the right person with the right idea and the right resources have come at the right time. And same, too, with the location. We pitched Wayne County Airport Authority about what we were proposing to offer at no cost to the airlines and at no cost to the airport. And they said, well, I tell you what, we'll give you this, this used to be a conference room, near A43. And we said, we'll gladly take that and, it's inside the TSA security perimeter, but it's very near the center so that, folks coming from any direction, have easy access, to our facility.
Well, it's always nice when you can get such prime real estate as an in-kind donation. That's wonderful of the Airport Authority and Delta Airlines to help in that regards. Can you talk some more about during the daily operations, sort of what a typical day at the Freedom Center looks like and the types of services and amenities provided?
Sure. Before 6 o'clock in the morning, every day of the week, our early volunteer shows up and turns the lights on and starts the coffee pot. And almost immediately, we have guests signing in. Often at that hour, it's the folks that are getting off the red-eye flights coming in from the West Coast. And frequently, they have a couple hours layover before their next connection. So they'll come in and help themselves to a snack or a beverage. Often grab one of the Lazy Boy chairs, or we even have a triple-decker bunk bed with fresh linens and pillows, compliments of Delta Airlines. And folks will often take a quick power nap there before they continue on with their next flight. And every 4 or 5 hours, we rotate. We have a new volunteer or two that show up. And during the day, we receive donations, both cash from travelers passing by and from various vendors in the airport, supply us with in-kind donations of various snacks and beverages and travel amenities. And on a good day, we have 150 people coming through, and during the holiday season, we can easily double that. So it's a busy place.
And can you say you do this primarily with volunteers? How many people volunteer at the Freedom Center?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we have one paid employee who is the overall day-to-day supervisor, and the rest of our staffing is volunteers coming from not just within the airport community, but from all over Southeast Michigan. Some folks drive more than an hour just for the privilege of being able to serve as a volunteer at the Freedom Center. And all in total, we have about 60 or 65 volunteers that share those duties throughout the week.
And you've mentioned that these good works can't go on without your sponsors. Can you give maybe a plug to some of your key sponsors?
Absolutely. We've had good support from the community, and one of the most recent contributions has been from Delta Airlines, as you mentioned, also Wayne County Airport Authority, the Meritor Corporation over in Troy is a big defense contractor, and they've been with us the entire 3 years. General Dynamics Land Systems that builds the tanks. They've supported us. Association of the U.S. Army, the chapter that's headquartered in Detroit, the Arsenal of Democracy chapter, has been very supportive. Just last week, We received a very generous donation from the Base Community Council out at Selfridge, and the list goes on, and probably most importantly is the donations that we get from the veteran service organizations, the American Legion Post, the VFWs, the Vietnam vets. They've all stepped up to the plate and been very generous.
Well, Ken, I know this is a labor of love by a lot of different people who realize that particularly in-transit military personnel should not have to be laying on the floor or trying to sleep on those benches, but should have some place that they can go and decompress and relax and make sure that they have the necessary services. So you're really providing a great service to those military members in transit and their spouses who are often traveling alone and lonely. Can you give us your website so if people want to donate or help out, how do they get to you?
Yes, our website is MI, as in Michigan, MIFreedomCenter.org. And that has all the details for volunteering and donating. And if I might close with this comment, our guest list, we welcome active duty, guard, reserve, dependents, allied soldiers, retirees, and veterans. Yes, any veteran who has served in the United States military is welcome at the Freedom Center.
Well, we're glad to shed a little light on the Freedom Center, which is somewhat new here at Metro Airport, as you can hear the music working our way out. Thanks, Ken. We appreciate your time. And when we come back after the break, we'll move on to Tom Young.
Schoolcraft College is proud to have served the communities of Southeast Michigan for 5 decades. So it should come as no surprise that they're just as committed to serving those who have served our country. Schoolcraft College Veteran Services provides assistance to veterans using their educational benefits. They help with the VA benefits application process, provide academic advising, and plan programs of study according to VA guidelines. Classes are forming now in Livonia and Garden City. Visit schoolcraft.edu for more information.
And welcome back on Veterans Radio. We hope you're enjoying the show, whether you're listening on WHAM 1600 Talk Radio or on the Internet at veteransradio.net. We hope you, if you're on the Internet, you go over and like us on Facebook so you can continue to follow along on upcoming shows. Joining us now is the author of Speed of Heat, Thomas W. Young. Tom, say hello to the Veteran Radio listeners.
Well, good evening, and thanks so much for having me on. It's nice to be with you this evening.
Well, it's great to have you on. Let me tell our listeners that you are retired from the Air Guard in 2013 after more than 20 years of service.
Yes, sir.
You have logged nearly 5,000 hours as a flight engineer on the C-5 Galaxy and the C-130 Hercules. You had the opportunity to touch down or visit in different fashions nearly 40 countries. Had combat missions not only in Afghanistan and Iraq, but also Bosnia and Kosovo. So you bring a lot of real-life military experience to writing Speed of Heat. You also have a career as a writer for the Associated Press, so you know how to turn a phrase as well. Isn't that correct?
Yes, sir. I spent 10 years with the AP, and parallel to the journalism career, as you mentioned, I spent 20 years flying with the Air National Guard. It's sort of an unusual combination of interests, I'll admit, but it led me to writing these books, and I've been quite fortunate.
Well, one of the units you were with was once 67th Airlift Wing out of West Virginia, where you were a senior master sergeant and flight engineer. Where your two careers kind of intersect, it seemed to me, is it also when you went off to Afghanistan and Iraq, you were a natural to keep a journal, weren't you?
I was. A buddy of mine, one of the pilots in my squadron, once told me that I was the ultimate embedded reporter because I kept a journal when we began to deploy for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. At that time, I had been out of the news business for a while. I worked for the AP from 1987 to 1998. But when my unit began to deploy and my squadron mates began to come back with all these great stories of some of the missions they had flown, some of the things they had done, it sort of kicked in the old journalistic instincts again, and it dawned on me that these guys and gals have some great stories, and these stories will get lost if no one writes them down. So with my commander's blessing, I began to interview my squadron mates. I sat down with about 70 of them, one at a time, and they told me their stories in their own words while I rolled a tape recorder, and I transcribed and edited down all of the interviews, arranged them roughly in chronological order, beginning with 9/11, also arranged them into chapters based on various subject matters. And that became the book, The Speed of Heat, an airlift wing at war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it tells the story of one airlift unit in the early days of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars.
Well, I think it does it in an interesting fashion, and Dale, we love veteran stories here at Veterans Radio.
Absolutely, that's our job.
So he
gets these stories out.
He talks to 70 folks and distills them down, and so you get three or four different views on the same event. And some of these views change, don't they, Tom, based on what job the veteran, or at that time the active duty member, had and where he was looking out of the plane.
Yes, sir, that's true. It's kind of interesting to get different people's perspective on the same event, because people see things from different angles, literally and figuratively. People experience different things in different ways. And I like it that you mentioned how we hear from people in different jobs, because that's one of the things I tried to bring out in The Speed of Heat. You know, it's not just about pilots and air crew members, but I interviewed mechanics, flight medics, flight nurses, Air Force security police, EOD people, pretty much a sampling of all the different job specialties within within our unit. And I think it paints a pretty broad picture of all the different skills, all the different kinds of work it takes to make that mission happen.
So let's talk a little bit about what, for our listeners who may not know, what a C-130 is and what an airlift wing is. Can you explain that a little bit?
Okay, yes, great. The C-130 is a four-engine turboprop transport plane. Although it doesn't look anything like a Boeing 737, it's roughly the size of a 737. And we use it to haul everything. I've hauled paratroopers, bomb-sniffing dogs, 500-pound bombs, construction materials, meals ready to eat, fuel and hydraulic fluid. I once talked to a crew that hauled Buckshot, the West Point mascot, which is a mule. We literally carry anything and everything. The C-130 has been around since 1954, and they're still making new ones.
Well, and it provides the military global reach, doesn't it?
It does. That's the motto of Air Mobility Command, global reach. Well, that's the Air Force motto, is global reach and global power. And the Air Force's mobility forces, the airlifters, provide that reach. And the C-130 is certainly the workhorse of the Air Force.
You told some stories about transporting friendly soldiers from Afghanistan or Iraq, moving them around the various countries. Can you give us a little sense of how they viewed their time on a C-130?
Some of the Afghan troops that my unit transported had never flown before. And so I personally did not fly any of those missions, but a lot of my squadron mates did. And they tell me that some of those guys took it in stride. Some of them were quite nervous about flying. Of course, you're always going to have some first-time flyers who get sick, especially if you're flying low-level in turbulence. I imagine it was quite an experience for an Afghan soldier who's never been on an airplane before to get on a C-130, and now he's flying low-level at about 300 miles an hour.
And you also transported, your wing ended up transporting some of the unfriendlies out of country, I think maybe as far as Gitmo.
That's true. Some of my squadron mates did transport some high-value detainees. Personally, I did not fly any of those missions, but some of the guys did. And, of course, those kinds of missions are very high-profile. It's a time to make sure you cross all your T's and dot all your I's.
Well, one of the jobs you interview throughout, one of the guys you interview throughout, and his job is loadmaster. Can you tell our audience a little bit about what the loadmaster's role is on a C-130 transport?
It's a very important job. The loadmaster oversees the loading of cargo on an aircraft. He makes sure that the load is positioned on the aircraft so that it falls within the with the aircraft's center of gravity limitations, with the weight and balance limitations. You can't put cargo just anywhere on an airplane. Depending on how much it weighs, it has to be placed at a certain point in the cargo compartment. But loadmasters do much more than that as well. When we do airdrops, they check the rigging of the parachutes and so forth. They make sure that the load exits the aircraft safely so that it doesn't hang up and cause a critical problem for the aircraft. When we're transporting passengers, they take care of the passengers. They watch for signs of physiological distress. You know, for example, if someone has an ear block or something, if we're flying unpressurized, the loadmaster is a very, very important air crew member. They often joke that it's the pilots and flight engineers' jobs to drive them to work.
Well, one of the things I thought was interesting, too, was the challenge the loadmasters have because the weights that they're getting for palletized material or others when in theater all go back to whether or not the scale's right on the weigh-in. And I thought that was created an interesting chain of problems all the way up to the navigator and the pilots.
It can. I recall making a takeoff from a remote dirt strip in Afghanistan. And prior to flying that mission, I had done all kinds of mission planning along with the pilots getting ready. Supposedly, the runway was 4,000 feet of packed clay, and of course you have charts and graphs that tell you at what temperatures and what power settings and what weights, you know, how much of that runway you're going to need to take off. So we had planned all this to the nth degree. We get there the next day and we land and we find out that runway is not really packed clay. It's more like 4,000 feet of soft dirt and big rocks. So that by itself kind of negates some of the calculations that we had made. So that might have been part of the issue. It might have been that some of the cargo that we put on was heavier than we thought. These factors can be unpredictable in the fog of war. But the bottom line is we got ready to leave, pushed the throttles to the stops, the pilots released the brakes, and we ate up every bit of that runway before we got to flying speed. It was quite a white-knuckle moment, but all's well that ends well.
Well, that was actually a riveting section on everybody's view on this really short dirt runway where kicking up rocks also caused damage to various hydraulic lines and the need for, we'll call it, not necessarily manufacturer-required fixes.
That's true. We often flew with flying crew chiefs, and they can make quick and dirty combat repairs. I do recall that after that particular flight, we landed in Kandahar, and I got out of the airplane and did a little inspection of the aircraft. It's been a long time, honestly. I don't remember if we had brake lines severed. If we did, I'm sure the crew chief was able to fix them. We did have some antennas get knocked off, but they were antennas for radios that were not critical for the next leg of the flight back to our base in Oman. So we sort of looked at the condition of the aircraft and determined that with the fixes made by the crew chief, it was still going to be safe to fly, and then we pressed on back to base. But it was quite an eventful day. And when we got back to our base in Oman, this is in the spring of 2003. We get back to base. By the time we land, it's dark. We had a terrific aircraft commander who was always thinking about his crew and keeping our morale up. And we got out of the airplane, we got in the crew bus to go back to our tents, and he said, "Guys, it's been a long day, tough mission, but we accomplished everything, and I just want you to know I enjoyed working with you, and I had a heck of a good time." And one of our crew members piped up and said, Sir, I'm glad you had a good time because it scared me to death.
Yeah. So one of the interesting things about your airlift wing is you're really moving from one country to another across the region, and maybe you can talk about where you start and where you end and what the stops during the during that work day might actually be.
Yes, in the early days of the Iraq War, we deployed, and we were based in Masirah Island, Oman, which is at the southern end of the Arabian Peninsula. And that was an ideal location for an airlift unit like ours, because from there, we could reach both Iraq and Afghanistan at the same time. So on any given day, you might fly to Baghdad, you might fly to Balad to support Operation Iraqi Freedom. Very next day, you might fly to Kandahar or to Bagram in Afghanistan. And also from Oman, we flew airlift missions to the Horn of Africa to support counter-terrorist operations there. So it was an interesting time because all in a day's work, you could take part in military operations in three different theaters.
I think most of us never think about it that way, so I wanted you to tell that story a little bit. So a very, very interesting piece of the book, The Speed of Heat. Dale?
Hi, Tom. This is Dale Frommer. I flew helicopters in Vietnam and had to get out of the way of C-130s every once in a while.
Well, thank you for your service, sir.
Thank you. Thank you as well. How would you describe your typical day? Is it a 12-hour day or 18-hour day or... Or how did it go for you guys?
Typically, in a C-130, when we were deployed, a day might run 16 hours. It sort of depends on whether you have tactical events such as airdrops. But during the longest deployment that I took part in, which again was in 03 when Iraqi Freedom kicked off, typically, you would alert at about 0500. You'd have a quick breakfast, and then you would go to your tactics and intel briefing, and that would take about an hour. Then the enlisted crew members would go to pre-flight the aircraft, and it would take me about 45 minutes to do a pre-flight inspection on a C-130 if I didn't find anything wrong. During this time, the pilots are still in ops. The pilots and the navigator are still in ops doing some last-minute mission planning. So if we alerted 0500, typically we'd take off by 8 or 9, depending on what's happening. And on a given day, you might fly, say, you take off from Oman, Inti, you'd fly to Kuwait, pick up cargo and refuel in Kuwait, fly to Baghdad, drop off cargo there, hop over to Balad, drop off cargo there, and maybe even hit a third spot in Iraq to pick up or drop off cargo, then come back to Kuwait and refuel, and then go back to home base in Oman. So it could be quite a long day with multiple legs.
Some of those flights, how long were the flights from Oman to Baghdad, let's say?
We never went straight from Oman to Baghdad, but and pardon me, it's I don't have my logbook in front of me, so I'm relying on memory from quite some time ago, but I think it would take us about 4 or 5 hours sometimes to get from, or 3 or 4 hours to get from Masirah Island to Kuwait. And then from Kuwait, it was a fairly short flight to places like Baghdad, perhaps an hour or so, a little bit longer if you were going farther north to some place like Mosul or Kirkuk. It could be quite a long day, long legs, if you were flying from Oman to any of the locations in Afghanistan. It would be several hours to get to Kandahar. Or to Bagram. Of course, you'd have to land a refuel there. And
Tom, I'm going to have you stay with us. We're going to go to a short break from one of our sponsors. We're going to come back and talk some more about the speed of heat.
Living at American House is like being on a cruise ship with all the lovely surroundings, the many, many activities, and the people to share with. It's so comfortable to be here. I feel safe. I don't have to shop. I don't have to cook. I don't have to clean up.
When you move into an American House senior living community, you open the door to a new world of possibilities. Our life enrichment directors are committed to enhancing the lives of residents every day. We look forward to finding out what interests you.
I just get dressed up and walk down to the dining room and enjoy my meals in the company of other people at my table.
For more moments made in American House, go to AmericanHouse.com. Again, that's AmericanHouse.com. Or watch us at YouTube.com/AmericanHouseLiving.
Living here has enriched my life. I'm Carol Huck, and I made in American House.
Welcome back to Veterans Radio. We're talking to author and veteran Tom Young, who has written a number of military adventure books, which we're going to talk about here in a moment, but trying to wrap up on The Speed of Heat, an airlift wing at war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Tom, I want you to talk a little bit about flying this beast, the C-130 beast, with night vision goggles. I thought this was an interesting part of the book where you talked about the training and then ultimately the implementation of it in the theater of war.
Yes, that was a fantastic experience. Prior to 9/11, my unit, the 167th Airlift Wing of the West Virginia Air National Guard, had a terrific commander, and he held us to very high standards. And the standard he set was that anything that airplane can do, you're going to be qualified to do. You're going to become fully qualified and proficient, and you're going to stay that way. And he demanded 105%, and as long as you gave him 105%, you had no problem. So what that meant was that whether you were a full-time Guard member or a part-timer, you had to make sure you got current in night vision goggles, you got current in airdrops, you got current in everything the C-130 was capable of doing. And, of course, you know, nobody had a crystal ball. Nobody knew what was coming on 9/11. But because that the commander had set that standard, when 9/11 happened and we began to deploy, we were ready. We didn't have to jump through a lot of hoops to get qualified to go do our combat mission, because all we had to do was pack up and go. So we were already comfortable with flying on night vision goggles. And that's something that takes some training to get used to, by the way. They can be very distracting if you're not used to flying with them. And I know of cases of crews that got kind of wrapped around the axle and with some of their early missions on NVGs because they weren't used to using that particular piece of equipment. But luckily, our commander had made sure we were used to them before we ever got there. And I once talked to him. I interviewed him for The Speed of Heat, and I asked him about his command philosophy, and he put it very succinctly. He said, when you go into a combat environment, just being in that environment is going to be stressful enough. You don't need the additional stress of having to teach yourself to learn to use a new piece of equipment. So he said, I want to make sure you guys don't have that stress. He said, that's what I can do for you before you get into combat. And it really did work. So when you're flying on night vision goggles, it sort of looks like you're viewing the world through dark green sunglasses looking at broad daylight. And it really is a tactical advantage.
Well, it certainly was a tactical advantage for your C-130 mates, but also while you can train with night vision goggles, you were flying really different terrains, whether it was mountainous terrain in Afghanistan or heat and desert dust in Iraq. How did those different terrains impact the airlift wing?
In Afghanistan, when we were flying through that mountainous terrain, doing low-level runs in and out of valleys and so forth, even on the darkest night, you had enough, I guess, starlight and moonlight for the NVGs to amplify, so you had a pretty good picture of what you were flying through, even though you were looking only through your night vision goggles and all the lights of the aircraft were off. The terrain in Iraq, especially southern Iraq, was quite different. Flying over that featureless desert in southern Iraq, everything sort of starts to look alike. And if there's any overcast, it takes away it takes away all of the lighting for the night vision goggles to amplify. So I can recall some nights flying over southern Afghanistan when you were looking out of your windscreen on your night vision goggles, and you really couldn't perceive anything, and you were essentially flying on instruments, and that sort of raises the hair on the back of your head. But yes, the terrain that you're looking at, and whether you have any cloud cover taking away your starlight, can make a great deal of difference.
Well, again, a very interesting section of the Speed of Heat. I'd recommend it to folks. I wanted to get to one more thing before we move on to the military adventure books that you've written, because I don't think I've read about the Ravens anywhere but in your book, because as you said, you interviewed all kinds of different MOSs or job classifications, and one group you interviewed were the Ravens. Can you explain what Ravens are to our listeners?
Ravens are specially trained Air Force security police, and it's their job to provide security for aircraft and for air crew members. And they'll send a Phoenix Raven team with a crew if we're flying into a place where security at the airbase is considered inadequate. A Raven team is usually three security police members. There can be four. They wear flight suits like the rest of us, so from a distance, you don't know who's a Raven and who's a crew member. And I've flown into some fairly sketchy places with Raven guys, and it was always a comfort to know that they're there.
Well, that's a nice shout out to them in your book, and some of them got a chance to sort of explain their background. It's a real good read. Again, something I can recommend to folks. The Speed of Heat is with. Is published by McFarland Publications. You can find it at McFarlandPub.com. But I wanted to quickly turn to sort of your current career, which is to write well-received, critically acclaimed military adventure novels. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, sir. I have always been interested in writing fiction and writing novels. Going back to college, I took creative writing classes. But for the longest time, I never had a plot idea that I could really sink my teeth into. And then my unit got activated. We started flying in and out of Afghanistan. And my crewmates and I would be flying along, looking down at those Hindu Kush mountains, at that rough terrain, and thinking, man, this would be a bad place to go down. And I thought, yeah, this would be a bad place to go down. And what would that be like? What would that experience be like? And the imagining of that fear, if you will, became the germ of the idea for my first novel, The Mullah's Storm. I was lucky enough to get a good agent and a good publisher, and the publisher wanted a sequel, and the series has rolled from there. So back in this past July, the fifth in the series, Sand and Fire, came out. I'm finishing up the sixth in the series now, a novel called The Hunters, which comes out next summer.
Give us a little bit about who your characters are and what you're trying to get across.
Well, what I hope to do is convey to a civilian reader, to any reader, really, the motivations and mindset of people who choose to serve. I have two main recurring characters throughout this series of novels. One is an Air Force flyer named Michael Parson. The other one is a female Army NCO, a Sergeant Major Sophia Gold. And actually, in my last couple of novels, she's out of the active duty military. She works with the United Nations, but she's still a member of the Ready Reserve. So those two characters recur throughout the novel. And then I also have other minor characters that come and go depending on the story. I have a Marine Corps character, Gunnery Sergeant A.E. Blunt, who started as a minor character in my third novel, The Renegades, and I got so much positive feedback about that character that I brought him back as a main character in Sand and Fire, my most recent novel.
Well, Tom, I think you've hopefully whetted people's appetite to go to your website, which is tomyoungbooks.com, or to their favorite book provider, whether it's Amazon, Barnes & Noble, on the Kindle or Nook, and get not only The Speed of Heat, but also some of your adventure novels. We really appreciate you telling your stories here and how you did it in The Speed of Heat. So we really appreciate that, and we want to thank today's program sponsors, American House, my law firm, Legal Help for Veterans, School Craft College, Lynn Pitlack, and Rally Point. We are out.